What's up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Austin Meyer Podcast, the show in which I interview amazing storytellers in all sorts of genres about how they craft the stories they tell. My guest today is Devin Concannon, who is one of four editors on ESPN's mega hit 10-part documentary series, The Last Dance. The Last Dance revolves around the career of Michael Jordan, with a particular focus on his last season with the Chicago Bulls. The project itself is a beast of an endeavor. We're talking 10 episodes, over 100 interviews, and according to director Jason Hare, 10,000 hours of footage to sift through. And that includes every game from every main character they had and every news report that had been done on them, both nationally and internationally. While I was watching the series, and I loved every minute of it, by the way, I couldn't even wrap my mind around editing something that big. How do you go from 10,000 hours of footage to a 10-hour series? And how do you make it a hit? I mean, The Last Dance averaged 5.65 million viewers across all 10 episodes when they premiered on Sunday nights over the course of 5 weeks in April and May, making it the most watched ESPN documentary of all time. So I turned to editor Devin Concannon to ask some of these questions. Devin is an editor based out of New York City. He is an NYU film school graduate. He edited Rest in Power, the Trayvon Martin story, and Fire Fraud about the infamous Fire Festival before joining the Last Dance team. So we're going to get into it. We're going to get into the nitty-gritty of editing something like this, how he got involved, some of the challenges that came his way and the team's way when everything got moved up during the pandemic. So we're going to jump into it. But to get us feeling that Last Dance vibe, I'm going to kick off this episode with the Last Dance series trailer. And after that, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Devin Concannon about how this story took shape. So hit the trailer.
You guys not allowed. No, I'm just kidding.
What time is it?
My mentality was to go out and win at any cost.
Jordan is the most talented player in the NBA, by far.
The show of the 90s, the team of the 90s.
How you doing?
Whenever they speak Michael Jordan, they should speak Scottie Pippen.
We created an image that people want to live up to. I think that's all you can hope for.
Devin Concannon, thank you so much for joining me on the Austin Meyer Podcast. I am hyped to have someone who was involved so heavily in creating one of my favorite series that I have seen in a long time. So thank you so much for joining the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
For sure. So I thought I would start out with this, with kind of where we're at in terms of the documentary space and the pandemic right now. One of the things I'm really interested in is for a lot of us like me and so many in this industry, when the pandemic started, it really shut down a lot of the documentary industry. We were just talking before we put record on, it's really halted a lot of production and shooting. But it seems like for you, the last few months has been a whirlwind since the pandemic started with editing and then the series coming out. So like, what's, if you can reflect a little bit on what the last few months have been like, well, what has that been like for you?
Yeah, sure. Well, so we were finishing up the series. The series was supposed to air in June. It was supposed to air in conjunction with the NBA finals, actually. And you know, in March, we probably had six episodes about locked. Five and six still had a little bit going on. Seven and eight were still pretty much in flux, and nine was hardly worked on at all. 10 was like hardly had anything by the time you know, we started being like, are we coming to work next week? Like, what's going on? And so, you know, it was really scary. My first thought when the NBA was suspended was, well, now this buys us extra time. You know, the NBA finals are going to be a month later or something like that, you know.
Right.
But in actuality, it was the complete opposite. I figured out within like basically 24 hours, they were like, yeah, no, they're going to want this out in April now. Mm. So suddenly we were extremely crunched for time and we all had to start working from home.
Gotcha.
So, you know, we like that weekend, basically the weekend of like the 12th, 13th, 14th of March, our producer, Matt Maxson, was just like frantically copying and dropping off drives for people, like, you know, 35 terabytes or whatever of media so we could finish up this series from home. And, you know, I mean, we all had our little home workstations and we were having our kind of daily Zoom meetings and talking about cuts that way.
Yeah, I love that. That's throwing it back to you know, probably when you started editing videos, as you know, when you were younger, just like sitting in your room at home, like throwing it together.
Yeah, right, exactly. Kind of like making my own hours too, because, you know, just like as long as the work gets done, everybody's happy. So it was cool. Like it was odd, of course, and it was frantic. I mean, we had a lot to do in order to make this thing get on the air by April. But we made it happen, and huge props to Jason, our director, and our producers for like really putting together a pretty seamless work from home situation like overnight, basically.
That's amazing. Well, before we get into kind of the nitty gritty of the editing, I'd love to hear a little bit more about your background growing up, how you got interested in filmmaking, and what led you to editing as a specialty?
So I started the first documentary I edited. I was actually 13. We had this thing at my school called National History Day, which everyone had to do as part of like a history project, and you get to choose a format. You could do a poster board, essay, you know, speech, whatever. And I partnered up with my friend Ethan, and we did a documentary. And besides it just being like a school project, like there's a competition aspect to it. So if you win for the school, you go to the county and then the state. And we ended up going to nationals the first year. We did this thing about the newsboy strike of 1898. Have you ever seen the Disney movie Newsies?
Okay, yeah, yeah.
It's about the same thing.
Nice, all right.
Yeah, so I started, you know, right off the bat, we were, you know, bang our heads against a laptop until 5 a.m.
Yeah.
Doing the same exact thing I do now. You know,
was that like
all these all-nighters? And
was that like an iMovie back in the day, or what were you using then?
The first
pre-iMovie.
I think it was this thing called Cinestream, which was like a really, really old, I think they went out of business probably that year.
Yeah. The Super Nintendo of editing software.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And then I think the next year we were on Premiere, Final Cut. And then when I was going to college, I mean, I have always been really into film, and I ended up going to NYU for film, and I went there with an open mind. I wanted to try everything, but, you know, I figured out that what I did best and what I liked the most was editing.
And kind of captivated you when it came to editing? Why do you think you were drawn to that?
I think part of it is a little bit of like the puzzle solving aspect of it, you know, and also I don't mind, you know, sitting in a dark room alone trying to figure something out and coming out with something that nobody was expecting you to be able to come back with. I just found it rewarding, and I found that not a lot of people like to do it, so I was always willing to be the one to do it, you know, and I realized that I was good at it and I liked it. So, yeah,
that's cool. When you think back to, going to film school at NYU and kind of like those early days of learning the craft as an editor, do you remember any, pieces of advice or lessons that you learned that were like super critical on your journey to becoming a better editor? Or was it just like the grind and the reps and you get better over time, which is, you know, how everything works?
Yeah. I guess for me, it probably was more like the grind and the reps. My second year of college, I got an internship actually at the Weinstein Company. Mm-hmm. I ended up interning there like every year and during the summer for like the rest of college. And I was working in the post department there. I feel like I learned more on the job even than I did at school. Yeah. I mean, in particular to editing.
Right.
So it wasn't like one lesson or one film that, or something that made something snap for me. But I think just being around it at an early age, and sort of being able to climb my way up in that company, and I ended up getting hired there right out of college. So, and that also happened to be a very peculiar company for post-production, because Harvey, before his new reputation, his old reputation was for really going all out in post and trying every, you know, a million different cuts of every single movie. And
oh, really?
So, you know, I was able to witness some really amazing editors respond to him and work with him. Yeah. And they helped me, you know, make a career of my own.
So the last few years you've been working, it seemed like from doing some research, primarily in the documentary space. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So for editors like yourself, is it kind of a decision that you have to make at some point that I'm either going to go mostly to documentary or mostly to features? And how does that work?
There is definitely a decision and aspect to it. I think for some editors, it's what jobs they were able to get. And for some, it's, you know, maybe a passion from the start and they wouldn't accept, you know, the other style of job if they were maybe holding out to specifically work in docs or something. Mm-hmm. For me, I was able to get my feet wet in a little of everything while I was at the Weinstein Company. And by the time I was ready to leave there, I mean, like I said, documentary has kind of been a passion for me for my whole life. So I, you know, I had a few opportunities to leave, but I was able to get this gig on a documentary as just an associate editor. And I decided like, this is the time to go, you know. Mm-hmm. Ended up being a great time to go because that was like spring 2017. And then Harvey went down like that October. Right, so I got out at the right time.
Wow.
But I hated him. So I was really happy to leave. And it was really great that I was able to you know, hop right onto a documentary. Mm-hmm. And from there, the jobs kind of snowballed with documentaries. And, you know, in a lot of ways, I got very lucky. But, but you know, I would have liked to have a documentary career if I had gotten two narrative gigs right out of Weinstein or something. It's possible I could have fallen in love with that way. Right. But I'm really happy with the way it turned out for me, at least.
Yeah, awesome. Well, I mean, you could say you got lucky with some opportunities, but also clearly you capitalized on those opportunities that presented themselves to you by doing an awesome job. So that's props to you. For those who don't have much experience or knowledge in the editing space, can you talk a little bit about the differences between what it's like editing something that is narrative versus a documentary? What are some of the unique challenges in this form that present itself to you?
Yeah. Well, the narrative, I mean, there's a script. There's a sort of order to the scenes that in a lot of times you have to stick to for whatever reason. The plot has to move a certain way. And so in that situation, the editor's job a lot of times is getting the best take, finding the right pacing and timing. And at times, you know, deciding we don't need this scene, or I can get away with losing this scene if we do this, when I was working on some narrative films early on in my career at Weinstein, some of the fun I found in it was some of that puzzle solving aspect where, you know, I was even writing voiceover where we could just use a take behind someone's shoulder and be like, listen, we don't even need this 4-minute conversation. If she just says this one line, you know, and then we'll get that actor to come in, record some lines in a voiceover thing. And I really enjoyed that challenge. And like I said, it was a great place to be doing a ton of experimenting and seeing what you can make work. But the reason I like working in documentary more is because as an editor in documentary, there's really no script. You have all of the interview material and you have archival material. Sometimes you have a narrator, but, in a lot of ways you're writing the movie, because you're saying like, okay, well, this is the total body of material we have on this subject. Like, we need to hear this, then we need to hear this. Somebody needs to say something like this, and we should be seeing this while, you know. So there's a much more, you know, in documentary, I'd say like editor, director, writer are much closer in terms of their creative, you know, responsibilities and creative input.
Absolutely.
Whereas a narrative, the editor has a sort of a different effect on it because the script is written already.
Yeah, that's interesting. So when did The Last Dance, when did they approach you about that project and how did you get involved with The Last Dance?
So one of the other editors on The Last Dance is Chad Beck. He's a great editor. And he and I worked together on a series a few years ago called Rest in Powers about Trayvon Martin. And so he and I worked together on that. And then I did one other gig, and that was like the Fyre Festival thing.
Yep.
And towards the end of that, Chad called me up one day and said, you know, I just got brought onto this Michael Jordan thing and I want to bring you on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, within a week or two, I met with Jason at a coffee shop and we hit it off, and, you know, it fell in my lap. It was really amazing. So and I owe Chad 1,000 beers for hooking me up with that gig.
Shout out, Chad. So when you're getting approached, so early on in the process of making this film, right, when they're reaching out to people, like, assembling that team, was the vision that it was going to be this massive 10-episode endeavor, and that's why they needed 4 editors? Or did you have any sense of how that team got assembled and what the initial plan was?
Yeah, so by the time I came on, the producers had been working on this for like over a year already. So they had been formulating the general concept of how the episodes would work. By then, it had already been decided it would be 10 episodes. And they had a vision for, you know, keeping one timeline that follows the thread of this season that we're in, the 97-98 season. And then using the moments from that season to flashback to tell the histories of the Bulls and the individual players.
Right.
So that much of it was already conceived. I know one of the things Jason told me in that coffee shop meeting was, you know, we want to have an episode where Michael is wearing his original Air Jordans. He wore them his last season, 97-98. That ends up happening, I think, in episode 5 now. He said, you know, we want to have an episode where we're starting this game and we see him stepping out and we see his original Nikes, and then we flash back to 1984 and tell the whole Nike story. And that is, you know, that is exactly how it happens in the episode.
Yeah.
So some of those ideas he and the producers had already envisioned and and a lot of it we just kind of figured out along the way.
And then what was your experience or knowledge of the subject material that you're coming in for, like whether in terms of being a Jordan fan or a Bulls fan or a basketball fan, and how does that compare to some of the other films that you've done before? Is it vital to have a ton of knowledge about the subject, or is that sometimes a really useful asset to have some fresh eyes?
Yeah, actually, that was one thing I was very upfront about as soon as I got this call, was like, I don't watch basketball. I don't hate basketball, but I never pay attention to it. Obviously, I know who Michael is. You know, I grew up in the 90s. I knew he was a champion many years in a row, but if you asked me like that first week that I got a call, I don't know that I would have said, I don't know that I would have known it was six exactly. Uh-huh. And so, you know, I made that very clear, but they were like, look, we have, we're like 60-40 here in terms of basketball fans and not. Mm-hmm. And we're looking for storytellers, not for basketball fans right now. So that was more important to them. And I think they need the series to make sense to people that don't like basketball. Mm-hmm. So to have some of the editors, you know, be on the team that don't know all the basketball terminology necessarily off the top of our heads, I think it helped. You know, I think somebody that was really into basketball maybe could put something together that may not make sense to everybody. Or right. They may just assume, oh, everybody knows what, you know, right, a triple-double is or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it definitely helped to have part of the team be like, hey, look, like, I don't get what this means, or somebody might not get what this means.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of some interviews I've seen done with the directors of Free Solo when they were talking about making that, because you had Jimmy Chin, who's the cinematographer, who's like deep in climbing world. He's a professional mm-hmm. climber. Mm-hmm. Then the co-director, Chai Vassarelli, is like, I don't care about climbing at all. And those two together as a team can really communicate to not only that broad audience, but can also like make it feel like a personal film to the people who are a part of that niche world.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So when you agree to come on to this project, like, what's your first step? I mean, because I'm here in my house doing like editing my own passion projects and stuff like that, trying to get my foot in the door in the doc world. And like the amount of footage that you guys must have had and different types of footage, like, I can't even fathom.
Yeah.
You know, absorbing all that. So what's the first step? You're like, okay, sign the contract, boom, boom, boom. What's next?
Yeah, I mean, my first few weeks in the job, it was actually a little weird because I came on a few weeks before the All-Star game that year, and they were planning on running some promos for some of the other team owners at the All-Star game. So my first few weeks, I was almost like trying to cut these promo things together. Not even like really getting into the nitty gritty of how much footage we had.
So this is like 2018. Are we talking?
No, this is January, February, 2019.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was on the, in total for like almost a year and a half.
Okay.
Finishing up, you know, early this year. So, that was kind of just like sink or swim, just like go, you know, here's what we're working with. Just like make something happen. Then once we finally got through that little like mad scramble, Jason, our director, actually was on the road for a few weeks because he's still finishing up interviews after that. So mm-hmm. I was just sitting in an office watching interviews for like weeks. Like, he had already done dozens and dozens of interviews at that point. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one day just watching all of Michael's, you know, 8-hour interview, selecting what I think is important, saving little things, making little notes to myself. And the next day, just jump into somebody else. Okay, I'll do Pippen today, Rodman, you know.
And so when you're going through and doing that process, what is your actual note-taking process like? Are you taking notes within your editing software? Do you have a little notebook and you're like, ooh, love that quote at this? Or here's a theme I'm thinking about, or what is it?
Yeah, a lot of times I'll sort of make sequences by category or by theme. You know, Michael Childhood or something like that. Mm-hmm. And whenever he says a line or a paragraph that I think, okay, this is the best of what we've got here, just throw it into that sequence, just kind of build something. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll leave a little marker. Let's say I have something called Michael Childhood. I'll have a marker at the beginning, like early sports, you know, sports as a kid, and then one like about his parents as a kid, like things like that. So it's categories within categories. You know, we call it like making a selects reel.
Okay.
So yeah, it's, you know, just finding what I think the most well said or the most genuine moments, emotional moments, things like that. So that when we get to cutting those scenes, we don't have to watch it all from scratch. We could say, okay, here's what's in the well.
Mm-hmm. So when you're taking in all that footage, did you already have a sense of like, I'm working on episode three, and the theme of that is this. How was that divvied up between the four editors?
Yeah, it was a little of everything. At times, we didn't know what we'd be working on next, and it was just like, I haven't seen this guy's interview at all or this woman's interview at all, and I should go through and just see what they have to say. Mm-hmm. Other times, you know, it was okay, like, yeah, like you're going to be getting into the beginning of episode three. It's going to be like these two games and, you know, beginning of Rodman's childhood, something like that. So, mm-hmm. okay, I'll go through everything Rodman has to say about it. I'll watch the game. I'll set aside the little lines from the broadcasters that I think are going to be, I'll be able to summarize this game in, you know, 40 seconds. Mm-hmm. We also had amazing associate producers and producers that would go through a lot of the game footage and make selects for us. So sometimes
they
would already be handing us like a pre-made sequence with all the best moments.
Mm.
And yeah, so a lot of times we dove into stuff already knowing, okay, this is what we're going for.
So you got to focus on like using those that interview and like the sound bites from that interview as kind of like that base layer of the story that you could really focus on, and you didn't have to spend like an exorbitant amount of time like watching the entire basketball game, taking like the perfect segments out.
Exactly. We had a lot of help with that. Zach Rothfeld and Jill Moosman were some of our associate producers, and our producers Matt Maxson and Jake Rogel and Nina Kirstick were all really, really helpful with all that stuff.
And then what was the collaboration like between editors? And part of the point that I asked that question from is like, you know, if I got a bunch of footage from basketball players talking about their sport and a basketball game, and I cut it and my friend Joe cut it, like it'd be completely different styles and language. Now you guys are top pros, so I'm sure that's something that is a skill that comes with that, but how do you maintain a cohesive flow between different episodes and editors?
You know, we were really trading scenes a lot, and sometimes it would be just saying, hey, like, I'm sick of this. I can't even like see it anymore. I don't even know if this is good. I think I'd probably ruin this, you know, and you give it to somebody else for 2 weeks. Maybe you take what they were working on. Sometimes the director would say, you know, let's say we sent off a rough cut to ESPN. We got some notes back. We'd go through the notes as a group, and the director would say, okay, I want you doing this scene now. You move to this one, you know, you move to this one. Mm-hmm. And luckily, I mean, this was one of the easiest to work with teams that I've ever been on. And we all had fairly similar sensibilities on a lot of things, particularly the editors. So it was really easy to give notes to each other and to receive notes from the other editors. And, you know, a lot of times I would feel like I got this scene to where I think it should be. But I think, you know, Abai or Ben or Chad, you know, I think one of you guys can probably bring this home better than I can at this point, something like that.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So all the editors really worked on like almost all the scenes, which was pretty great. Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
And how often are you organizing your thoughts or the structure of story outside the editing software on like note cards or in a notebook, or is there any other kind of strategy you guys are using to keep track of everything?
Yeah, so, well, there were giant, cork boards in the director's office where we had note cards, you know, basically 10 across episodes 1 through 10 and the sort of note cards that would go for each episode. And a lot of meetings were us just, like, standing around staring at this thing of cards being like, well, what if we just put this in episode 4 and move this here? Like, this, we can connect this thematically this way. No, because this has to chronologically do this. There was a lot of that, especially
that.
In this type of project. Yeah. And there were times where we would come in and look at the cards on the board and be like, this is so not what the episode is right now. Like, we've done so much in the editing room that like nobody even updated the cardboard. you know, so it was happening all over the place. But
we definitely... So now I'm going to keep getting even more specific on that one, because I'm fascinated by that. So, like, are you making note cards?
Rarely.
Okay, so it's like a director thing.
Yeah, the director or like one of the producers will maybe write it. A lot of times they say like, all right, who here has the best handwriting? You know, right. That came up a few times. But there would be times where people were out or out of the room or whatever it was, and I would just be in there with one other editor maybe, or one person. We'd be like, mm-hmm. we need this scene. And yeah, so then maybe I'd write a card.
Yeah, so it'd be like organizing on that corkboard, using like here's a scene. We know we need to have this game. Okay, so that's our scene. Who do we know who has some good quotes on that? Okay, write their name next to that or something like that.
Yeah, right, exactly. And so it was a lot it was very much about just organizing the flow of an episode to make sure that it made sense and accomplished everything that needed to happen by the end of the episode.
Mm-hmm. What was either a scene, an episode that posed a exciting or sometimes frustrating challenge for you, that seemed unique compared to some of the other projects you've done or challenges you've had?
There was some like behind the scenes stuff that we all thought made really great scenes, but for one reason or another, we were not allowed to use, which was really unfortunate. And you know, the chronology stuff was really, I'd say, the toughest challenge. We were constantly moving things around. An example that comes up a lot because it was just sort of a big moment for us was like the 91 finals, the first time they ever win a championship. For months and months and months, it was happening in episode 5, and we felt like episode 5 was supposed to be about Michael Jordan's rise as a hero, and 6 in a lot of ways was sort of about his downfall. It gets into the gambling, all that stuff, in the eyes of the public. And so we felt like the championship was really part of that. And eventually, you know, we started picking up momentum for the idea that like maybe we should move this to episode 4. And it was sort of a tough pill to swallow, I guess, but once we did and we really put the work in to reorganize the episodes accordingly, everything made so much more sense, and just it really felt right. And in the end, that's how it stayed. So the 91 finals, they end up winning at the end of episode 4.
Right.
So it was things like that, you know, you get attached to a certain idea because thematically it connects in a certain way. But if you can sort of, you know, they say, like, kill your baby and let it go. Sometimes you see something that you maybe didn't realize was there.
Yeah. And how did it feel to you working on those kind of two parallel timelines that seem pretty unique in this kind of docuseries format? And one of the things that I noticed, like, first of all, that I thought worked really well. I mean, I think the timeline that you cut to and is moving is like a really great just tool of orientation to figure out where we are. But I'm sure, especially when it comes to like someone like Dennis Rodman, who played for all these different teams and at different times, like, it could get really challenging. What was that like?
Yeah, the timeline graphic that you're referring to is really helpful. I think we, in the beginning, the first few rough cuts, we didn't have that sort of thing, and we were trying to do it all basically vocally. I mean, we were trying to get people to say, to reference, let's say they were talking about 98, oh, this reminds me of this thing. Like, it's just too tough. And I think once we got over the hump, like, hey, we can use this, and it's going to, more than that, it's going to help us, it's going to help the viewer, I think, in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And once we started working with those, that was a huge help. And like you said, with something like Dennis Rodman, there's so much trial and error with how we were going to organize his story and weave it into this story. You know, we felt like his and Phil Jackson's stories were very connected in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And they ended up airing together, episodes 3 and 4. Mm-hmm. And 3 is mostly about Rodman and 4 is mostly about Phil. And so we always knew that we wanted to connect them, but we had swapped the order so many times. When do we talk about the Bad Boys and Rodman and the Pistons, you know? And luckily for us, there was so much about the story that naturally fell into place and made for great storytelling. I mean,
yeah.
Rodman being such a great character and also being the third man on the team really worked out in our favor, because by episode 3, it should be about him. 2 was mostly about Pippen. 1 is, of course, about Michael. But also by episode 3, we're up to the point in Bulls history, starting from when Michael was drafted to a few years later, when now the Detroit Pistons would be the reigning champions. So, you know, it's time to talk about Rodman in our timeline, but it's also time to talk about Rodman in this history of the Bulls timeline.
Right, right.
And Phil, in a lot of ways, was the answer to the Detroit Pistons. He was the one who ended up instituting the triangle and helping the team overcome the Pistons. So the two things handed off so well, and their personalities are shockingly so similar, you know, and they had sort of a personal bond. So a lot of these things were almost like gifts to us as editors, because it just it works out so beautifully.
See that is one of the coolest things about documentary editing, right? It's sometimes because it's so spontaneous, the moments that you get when things do fall into place, it's just like feels like such a gift.
And you know, sometimes you, like you said, like outside of the editing room, you're kind of writing notes to yourself. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I woke up at 5 in the morning or something, or couldn't sleep, and suddenly it was just like, oh my God, this is what we have to do, you know? And like, I can't even remember what those things were, but it happened a bunch of times. And then I'd go into the office and be like, wait, I'm telling you, we just connect this by this, we can use this line, and things just come to you, because it's, the episodes are just playing in your head all day.
Yeah.
Even when you're not working.
You mentioned, you kind of talked about episode, I think you said 5 or 6 was kind of like the hero's rise. And then the next one is like the crash. I'm wondering if you could kind of put the 10 episodes into that, a very general like hero's journey, that kind of language that you're referencing, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So, I mean, that would pertain to the sort of historical timeline as opposed to just the Last Dance season timeline. You know, so episode 1 is sort of the origin story of Michael and him getting drafted, and 2 naturally is Pippen, because he's the number 2,
the partner in crime.
You know, Michael's drafted in 84, Pippen's drafted in 87, and it's, we sort of set up in the Bulls history, Michael was a star from the moment he entered, but he needed someone else. He needed help. And Pippen comes at just the right time, comes in 87. And so, you know, I guess for episode 3, I would say that's definitely the sort of setting up the villain, the Bad Boys, Michael's first big villain, and Scotty and Phil are going to help him finally take down the monster. We actually, we thought about like monster movies, like horror movies, when we were cutting the Bad Boys section and the Jordan Rule, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it
worked.
And so 4 also is sort of overcoming that. And at the end of 4, he's finally a champion. He's finally what everybody said he couldn't be. Mm-hmm. And so 5, he's riding that wave, you know, a couple more championships. He's the dream team now, gold medal. And people want to sort of take him off the pedestal. So 6, you know, the Jordan Rules is coming out, the book, I mean, the gambling stuff is coming out. And he's sort of getting exhausted. That's what we were trying to get across. I mean, he says in an old interview, after he wins the 3rd championship in 93, he was sitting on the gym alone. He's sitting on the floor of the gym alone after the game. And he was thinking to himself, I think, like, nobody knows it, but everyone just saw my last basketball game. Right. And he said he only told his father.
Right.
And so the beginning of episode 7, his father is killed. That's like, you know, just a few months after he wins that third championship. Yeah. And at that point, he's already been deciding, I want to retire. This is the sort of thing that puts him over the edge. And seven for me was by far the most fun episode to work on. I mean, his father's murdered. He goes, plays baseball, and the Bulls without Michael is a cool story. And
number seven is incredible. It's incredible. And I think what you're talking about, if you're looking at the 10 episode structure, like, you really have the lowest of lows in that episode and the highest of highs.
Yeah.
You know, you see like a genuine joy that feels a little bit different when he's playing baseball. And then it just kind of culminates in that, you know, last 3 minutes of the episode, which I've watched like on replay, like 10 times, like getting fired up for a run and stuff like that. Okay. So, and then so 8, 9, 10, like, let's finish that off. Yeah.
Yeah. 8 is kind of the comeback story. You know, he comes back, but he's not himself. He's still a baseball body. He has to work real hard. He goes and does the Space Jam thing where they build him a little basketball court, which is fun.
Yeah.
And you know, he comes back, and then it, that again, another amazing gift for us editorially, that his first, you know, full season back, he wins the championship on Father's Day, his first championship after his father's murdered, the first time his father can't be there to see him in the championship. And that it happened on Father's Day is just so beautiful from a storytelling perspective.
Yeah.
And of course, the footage of him after that game is extremely emotional.
On the floor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's sort of the culmination of the comeback story. And by 9 and 10, I mean, he's back in episode 9. We sort of catch up to our current timeline through having won the 97 finals. And 9 also is a lot about Steve Kerr.
Right. As a Bay Area guy who's a Warriors fan, I have appreciated those. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, 10 is 10. I mean, 10 is just the championship. Yeah. I mean, 10 speaks for itself.
Yeah. Were there ever times when did you do any production or shooting after you came on as an editor? Were there ever moments where you're like, ooh, I think we really would love to get a quote from his kids? Hey, Jason, can you go do an interview with the kids? Or was there anything like that happening, or not really?
I mean, by the time I came on, they had like maybe 30 or so interviews. And by the time it aired, we had like 108. They were doing interviews the entire time up until, I think we got John Stockton like February of 2020. Like,
oh, wow.
Yeah. Like that was the last interview we got. And it was, we were doing like, they were, I don't go to the interviews, but they were doing interviews, throughout that entire time. So a lot of times it would be like, okay, well, you know, this guy can only do this day. I'm flying out there in 3 weeks. Like, I know we're not working on this episode yet, but we need to figure out exactly what we got to ask him, because we need, like, he's going to be the primary storyteller for this.
And are you as editors in that conversation with the director, because you know what you have, you're looking at it and making those episodes every day. Are you saying like, we really need a little bit more reflection on this? If you could push there, that'd be awesome. Are you involved with that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, anytime there's an interview coming up, we all talk about it, and it's like, what do we need on this? What do we have? Okay. Nobody's really explaining this aspect of it. Can you get this? Or can you have him or her talk about this person? So it's almost always a team conversation. And a lot of times it was, the interviews happened because of that conversation. It was like, we don't have anyone talking about this. Who in the world can talk about this? You know, we need to,
right.
We saved Bob Costas for one of the very last interviews because he could fill in so many holes, because he's seen everything. And, you know, so he was
really
great, because,
interesting.
Yeah. And he's such a, you know, he's just so well-spoken and so, so well-informed about sports history that he can say things so perfectly, about pretty much any topic. So he was a really,
that's
we
amazing.
Sort of, yeah. A lot of times we would just leave a slate if we had no one talking about something and just sort of be like, Costas or somebody will say this, and just kind of like putting quotes and
so you're saying like when you're actually like prototyping storylines and the episodes, you're actually putting in placeholders like someone saying this here.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, even in the rough cuts that we're sending to ESPN, we'll just have just, you know, text on screen saying like, interview to come, this person will say something about it, you know.
Gotcha. So the at the time when you interview Bob Costas, and I'm assuming some of those kind of other journalists who can stand in for any part of that timeline, Jason's going in with very specific questions that are, he knows exactly where those are going in the episodes.
Totally. And it's both. I mean, he's going in with very open-ended questions too. You know, tell me about this game, but then also like, tell me about this play. What happened here? What's your knowledge of, you know, did you know Michael's father or whatever? Like a very specific thing.
Had you ever seen the interview tactic of giving the iPad out? Because I thought that was pretty delightful.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I don't know if I have ever seen that before. I don't think I have, but I thought it was great. I know a lot of people reacted after the episodes aired saying they wish there was more of it. And I think we all felt that way, but there were a few that didn't make it in for one reason or another, just either the storyline didn't make it or whatever it was. But I mean, some of them were some of the most raw moments and best reactions came out of those things.
Yeah. Some nice, like little verite kind of moments of just current spontaneous emotions. Those are cool.
Yeah.
So you all finished during the pandemic, you're hustling at home, finishing the edit. Quick, I'm curious on like spec stuff, like what, like editing, home editing office. Are you using Avid for this whole project? Are you on a beast of a computer? Just curious on that kind of, some of that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, we're all running Avid. Like I said, it's like 35 or so terabytes of material, but it's all on an external RAID. I was just running off my laptop. I mean, and I have some like monitors that I set up next to me. But yeah, I mean, I'm just running off of my MacBook. Nothing too crazy. I mean, it really was fine. I actually, like, it was almost like faster than the computers we were using at work.
And are you editing off proxy files?
We use like DNX36. And then they onlined elsewhere. I mean, they were basically did all the onlining at home also, which was, I was hardly even involved in that at all.
So what is the onlining? I'm not familiar with that term.
So that is where they actually get the raw, original, most high definition possible final version cut into exactly as we have it cut in with the proxies.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, so, you know, because then a lot of times we're cutting off of, the NBA would just supply us with reels that were an hour long of all just different news archival clips of people talking about something, and we're going to use 4 seconds of it. So by the time they go to onlining, okay, we only need to get the raw master footage of these 4 seconds from the NBA, rather than them giving us, like, I mean, then it would just be thousands and thousands, like, of thousands of terabytes
to
have all that raw stuff.
And then you're sharing the project across the four editors all the time. What kind of system is that, like, built into Avid? I just have used Premiere, so I don't really know how the workflow works.
Yeah, so Avid, the file and save structure is completely different than Premiere, where you just have a single project file, and Premiere has its bins and stuff organized that way. Avid has basically a Finder level structure, so a bin or like a folder is an actual file in your project folder. So when you're working on a sequence and you save it into a bin, you could just actually go into Finder, take that bin file and email it to somebody, and they open up the same sequence next to all the media on their drive.
Right.
And so we were constantly just emailing bins back and forth.
Gotcha.
And
did you guys get to have any kind of like team get together, celebrate, premiere, like you guys finish this off all separate, and then it comes out obviously a huge success in terms of audience, like dominating not even just sports conversation but just culture in general. Did you guys get to have a moment as a team to celebrate this accomplishment?
Not really, because because of quarantine, but you know, the night of the premiere, we were supposed to do an actual like sort of theatrical premiere in New York City. I think that was supposed to be in May, like a month before the original air date. Obviously that was canceled, but the night of the premiere, we sort of just did a Zoom toast, you know, with the team. That's all we could really do.
Yeah.
And then we did the same the night before, the night of the finale.
Very cool.
That one, actually, we were going to do a team thing. And then we got an email from Jason saying, you know, it looks like the Jordan team and NBA people want to do like a really massive Zoom team meeting. Ended up being like 50 or so people. And so in my mind, I'm thinking, is Michael going to get on this thing? Because it's like Jordan team. Like, why are they initiating this big Zoom call the night of the finale? But he did not join. Oh. it would have been really cool. I was like getting ready to screenshot at any moment, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
But he didn't join, but that's okay. Yeah, that's pretty much as close as we've gotten.
And then looking back on it, and it's now been about 2 months since that final episode aired. What is something that you are most proud of in terms of the creation of the story or how it's been received by the public?
I think I'm probably most proud of, I mean, you know, it's one thing that all my friends who were sports fans and basketball fans are texting me like, oh my God, I can't believe this is incredible, you know. But it felt a lot better to me when I would hear from, you know, relatives and friends and like my 95-year-old grandmother who don't know anything about basketball saying like, I can't believe how much I like this. You know, I can't wait till next week. My grandmother is calling me saying like, I didn't see Rodman in this game. Like, what happened to him? Was he hurt? Like she's like really, really getting into it. It's so great. And those were the moments that were most rewarding to me because it meant that the story was cutting through to everybody.
I love that. Yeah, I was getting to watch some with my mom. I found my mom kind of like, at first, the first episode, she was kind of sitting off on the side over at her desk, and then slowly but surely started moving over to the living room. Watch it. Right. It was so great.
Nice.
Before we wrap up with a final question, where can people learn more about you or find your work, or is there anywhere on social media or anywhere else that you'd want to send them or anything like that?
I mean, you know what? I usually just refer people to my IMDb.
Cool.
It's actually funny you ask because somebody emailed me this morning saying, hey, I got your email from your website. And I didn't have a website, or I didn't think I had a website. So I started Googling my own name to see if I had a website. And like, I found this WordPress thing that I was like very much a work in progress. I think it just has like my name, my email, phone number, and then like a little about me section that was like half written. I had no idea that this thing was published ever. Probably hasn't been touched in 6-7 years. So that actually just happened this morning. I'm going to try and delete that before this airs. So nobody can find it. But
well, I'll put your IMDb page in the show notes if people want to check that out and see what else you've worked on. So Devin, the final question that I got for you today is one that I end all my shows on, and that is just one last piece of advice that you have for people out there listening who want to become better storytellers in any sort of genre that they work in. What is one last piece of advice you'd like to leave people with?
You know, there's really a lot of value in fresh eyes and getting as many eyes on things as possible. Sometimes people have a really specific vision in their head and they know what they want, and it's hard to communicate that with people, and people maybe feel like they need to bring it home themselves. But I think, the value of having a lot of sets of eyes on things is easy to overlook. And, you know, if every show that I had ever worked on was exactly as I envisioned the scenes, they'd be pretty terrible. You need a team and everybody, you need a lot of discussion and back and forth before you can finally settle on the best way to tell something. Yeah. You know, I think that has been one of the biggest lessons, I guess, that I've learned over the years.
That's great. That's a great message. Amazing. Well, Devin, thank you so much for joining the show, and thank you for all your work on this amazing series, getting us through quarantine with a little bit of extra entertainment. I really appreciate it, man.
Yeah. Thanks again for having me.
That's it for episode 42 of the Austin Meyer podcast. Thank you so much to Devin Concannon for joining the show and to you for listening. If you're enjoying the show, please consider leaving a rating and review of the podcast on Apple Podcasts. And please reach out to me at Austin Meyer Films on social to let me know what you thought of the episode. I love hearing feedback from listeners about what resonated with you and who you'd like to hear me interview in the future. So please reach out. Also, if you're looking for some more sports movie inspiration, I just came out with my own short documentary titled Golden Hour, which I shot last year at the biggest ultra marathon race in the United States. And if you head on over to my YouTube channel, youtube.com/AustinMeyerFilms, you will find it there. And if you get a chance to check that out, I hope you like it. I am sending everyone love during these challenging times. I hope you and your loved ones are well. And with that, I will see you on the next episode of the Austin Meyer podcast. Until then, go out and tell some stories.